if I may. It may relate more to 3033, and I don't know if you want to deal with that now, but
whatever.
It's my sense, maybe you address this, but with the designation of a peace officer, we also affect how you folks fit into the collective bargaining process, perhaps. Ms. Botkin is shaking her head. If generally, peace officers are given the opportunity in lieu of striking binding arbitration. Can you tell me if this is going to have any impact on that situation at OLCC if we were to go ahead and adopt this?
If I may respond. excuse me. I choke on my gum. I never come up with gum. Representative Springer, I too have some experience with labor law, and I can assure you that your designation or non-designation of this unit as peace officers over what is already in the statutes is probably not going to have a large effect upon the decisions that ERB makes. The Employment Relations Board makes the decisions as to who goes into binding arbitration and who does not. Certainly the legislature does not make that decision, nor do I. We don't have that authority. It is strictly in ERB's or in the Employment Relations Board's hands, and we recently were not denied that status with this unit. Does not mean that we won't go back again at a later date, regardless of what happens in this session. I think that some things need to be clarified just simply because of the change in job duties. And as you look at the information that these gentlemen will hand out to you, I think that you will see that the changes have been somewhat significant, and the statistics of arrests and administrative violations. They have all these terms that I'm not used to using at this point. Administrative violations have demonstrated the change in the duties as assigned by the division director. Again, I don't think.
Let me another question, if I may, on a slightly different topic, and I guess it's directed to the enforcement officers themselves. It's my understanding that the 4,000 or so law enforcement officers in the state also have the responsibility to enforce the laws as it relates to possession of alcohol, et cetera. My sense is we've heard a lot of testimony today and in other hearings that local law enforcement, be it county sheriff, police, are literally strapped just to try to perform their own priority duties. To what extent would you gentlemen, based upon your experiences out there in the field, what's your sense in terms of the ability of local law enforcement, be it county or city officers, to really devote a meaningful part of their energies to enforcement of the liquor control laws, and perhaps their degree of training in doing so, and maybe as part of that, the extent to which you folks work with them on enforcement actions, if that is in fact taking place?
Hey, Mr. Chair and Representative Springer, I'm very glad you asked that question. I believe there's approximately 4,160 police officers in this state. At any one time, there can't be any more than about 20% of those police officers actually out on patrol. I've talked to the Chief of Police in Clown Falls, the Sheriff, and the State Police, and they've indicated that's a pretty fair figure. I think you've heard earlier today that in one county here in this state, there's only one, and most often nobody out on patrol. These police officers really rely upon us to enforce the liquor laws. I get called out at night, midnight, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning to assist them in teenage beer parties. I have the expertise. I have the time to come back that next Monday or Tuesday and do the follow-up and try to find out who the responsible adult or irresponsible adult it was who furnished that beer. They simply just, they're strapped. They have major crimes to investigate. I think if any of you have read the papers recently, there was a recent FBI figure that came out that indicated Oregon was ranked 5th on overall crime in the United States. They simply rely on us, the 27 liquor control officers in this state, I believe maybe it might be 29 now, maybe 28, to really focus in on these particular type of crimes.
Steve or Bard, I'd appreciate your comments,
yes,
too.
Yes, certainly. Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Springer, the OLCC is a regulatory agency. There are approximately 240 people that make up the various divisions. These two bills address a minute, small portion of compliance division affiliated regulatory field services. To some people, they've known it in the past as the enforcement division of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. These select few, 29 active positions, and I believe at this point in time, as I understand it, there are 27 active OLCC compliance inspectors. We have many parallel roads. We have the administrative rules that we regulate the licensees with, and we also have criminal laws that we regulate the public with. We work with the public and we work with the licensees. We have some overlapping. We can arrest for MIP, as can a police officer. We can arrest for furnishing, which a police officer can do. But we have other expertise that is listed in the purpose of the Liquor Control Act. I'm personally involved many times with moonshine stills or illegal importation. Those types of investigations are farther removed from the criminal law. They do appear on the criminal law, but we do have the expertise. The keg tag receipt, that when a person buys a keg, there are administrative and criminal sanctions for violation, which allow us to assist a DA or a police officer in the investigation of a fatality investigation. In the yellow handout that we gave you is a chronological, almost true chronological order of the events. In the 12 years that I've been with the commission, as I understand it, the ORS statutes have not been revised. We have the Attorney General's or Deputy Attorney General's legal opinion limiting the scope of the authority. The statute says we have all the authority. The Attorney General says we have a limited peace officer authority. There's a copy of the old operation manual, which limits us to liquor laws and licensed premises. There are some letters of concern, one from the Klamath County District Attorney, one from MAD. There's some responses. The new operational manual revised after public comment. And there are some statistics that came from the Central Oregon region. And we also have some photographs and some news articles with regards to a fatality investigation. And we have, lastly, the new license investigator and compliance inspector orientation and training program excerpts, which were given to our newest employees as of December 1986.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Springer, let me address that question which you asked. One, the police just really do not understand the Liquor Control Act like we do. Imagine us having three chapters of the Oregon Revised Statute and that's all we're responsible for. You get pretty good at enforcing it. If you will, we're the IRS of liquor control in this state. No police officer can begin to match us in our understanding of the Liquor Control Act, and I think that's a pretty that's a statement that no one is going to dispute. Secondly, the police just don't have the time to learn how to enforce these laws and to actually don't have the skills to enforce them. The Portland police have a system, a priority system that they've set up, 1 through 4. Liquor control laws fall in the 4 category, the lowest category. That's not to say they're not important. Obviously they are, and our agency probably exists because of that. I think, however, that we need to have the training for these inspectors to define what their role is so that they can go out and enforce the Liquor Control Act.
Okay.
Thank you.
Need to
Mr. Chair, if I can make
along.
Just one closing comment, I'd like to say what the issue isn't. You're going to hear testimony this afternoon that says
we
that
may not.
The issue is guns. Let me make two things very clear. Number one, currently under the law and under the administration, they have the right currently. Mr. Thomas is head of OLCC, can direct these officers to carry guns anytime he wants to. We have simply made a decision in the state that OLCC officers are not going to carry guns. The issue before you today does not change that. It does not alter that, nor is there any attempt with these two bills to alter that. It is certainly not our intent to suddenly arm all the OLCC officers, and anyone who indicates that that is going to happen needs to point that out to us, because certainly we do not see anything that supersedes the agency's right to arm or keep to arm their officers or keep them unarmed.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you. Mr. Eastridge?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Eastridge, and I'm the owner of Magoo's Tavern here in Salem. However, today I'm here as the legislative chairman of the Oregon Restaurant and Beverage Association. ORBA is a trade association of approximately 900 restaurants, taverns, lounges, and hotels. The provisions in House Bill 3032 and 3033 are not new, and they've been introduced before, and we ask that you give these bills the same fate they've received in the past. We're concerned about the possible impact of this legislation on the liquor law enforcement program in Oregon. It wasn't but 7 or 8 years ago, as a result of the Blue Ribbon Task Force and on the and the Sunset Review Committee, that the legislature directed Enforcement Division to concentrate its efforts on a regulatory campaign aimed at securing compliance. While we have not always agreed with the policies and the procedures of the Commission, the direction of that regulatory campaign has generally been positive. The Commission is focused on the liquor laws rather than on prostitution, drugs, and other criminal laws, and has developed programs that have achieved better compliance results because they have recognized most licensees are responsible operators. We totally agree with the Commission's current enforcement priorities, with its focus on illegal sales to minors, visibly intoxicated persons, and licensed establishments that are disorderly. Currently, the inspectors have complete authority to address these priorities. However, by designating them as peace officers, these bills might result in diffusing their liquor law enforcement efforts. We are also most concerned about the ramifications that these proposals could have on the Commission's policy to prohibit inspectors from carrying weapons into licensed establishments. We do not believe that guns are a necessary enforcement tool when securing compliance with liquor laws in a regulatory arena, and would urge that this committee table these proposals. Thank you for your time, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Philip Peach with Oregon Lodging Association, the state trade association for motels, hotels, and resorts. A fair number of our members are liquor licensees, and without being repetitious, for the reasons you've already heard in Mr. Eastridge's testimony, we would like for the record to be on record also in opposition to these two bills. Thank you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Hedlund? Bill Hedlund? Mr. Hedlund, I'm calling you if you want to come.
Good afternoon. My name is Bill Hedlund. I live at Lake Oswego, and I am one of the members of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I've been so busy at that since the year 1979. You've heard reasons for adopting these bills, but you also have heard some of the background reasons for the request of these people. I'm not going into great detail because Mr. Reed, who is a member of our staff, will appear before you and will enlighten you as to more of the detail. Particularly, I want to say that we have adopted a program over the past few years that has, I think, been quite successful in arriving at liquor law enforcement. We do not use the gotcha method of enforcement, which is simply a proposition of going out and finding out whether or not somebody's violating a law. A law against liquor sales and so forth. What we actually are doing now is putting a good deal of emphasis on not only the enforcement and compliance from the point of view of penalties, but we are also using educational methods. We have done it very pointedly and very commandingly, and we are proud of it rather than ashamed of it. We feel that they're giving the enforcement people any more authority than they presently have is unnecessary and undesirable. We do not want guns to be used in connection with liquor law enforcement, and we have established that as a policy and will continue to do so as long as we're permitted to do so. These officers are normally given the right to carry guns. These gentlemen have the authority of peace officers with reference to the enforcement of liquor laws, and we expect to carry on our program as we have in the past, and I think it's been quite successful. All of the liquor commissioners are opposed to these bills, and as far as we are able to determine, the administration is satisfied with the policy that we have tried to carry out, and we are definitely in opposition to the bills. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Hedlund. I didn't understand here that Mr. Reed is signed up on both these bills. So, Mr. Reed, do you want to come up now, and you can stay here if you want while he testifies?
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Reed, you're on for, unless is there a question, Mr. Hedlund? Mr. Hedlund, let me make sure I understand. You said that all liquor commissioners are opposed to this. Was there a formal discussion of this?
Yes.
Yes, commission
as a matter of fact, I'm sure it's in our minutes.
Thank you. Mike Reed.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Mike Reed. I'm the Director of Regulation of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I think, correct our chairman. I don't believe the commissioners have formally discussed this in one of their monthly meetings.
I thought we had.
I don't believe you have, but I know that individually all of the commissioners have expressed their personal opposition to these bills.
I'm sorry, and I'll stand corrected. I was not aware of that. I know that I've discussed with each of the other commissioners their opposition to the bill.
I am here speaking on behalf of the Commission staff, and our position is that we are opposed to House Bills 3032 and 3033. I'd like to briefly review the reasons that we're opposed. First of all, House Bill 3032 deals with BPST. We believe that BPST provides a good service and good training for basic entry-level patrol officers. However, that's not what our inspectors are. By and large, our inspectors are already trained investigators. You heard Steve, one of our inspectors, testify that in his opinion, about 65% of BPST was appropriate for OLCC inspectors. I've reviewed this matter with another person, another of our inspectors who has been through BPST. He concluded that about 30% was appropriate. The union representing our inspectors testified at the IRB hearing last year that 50% was appropriate. We won't quibble. We'll accept their representation that 50% of BPST is appropriate. The reason that we have elected to stop sending our inspectors to BPST is just that reason. 50% of it is inappropriate. We believe that we can provide better training, more to the point for the needs of our people, with less cost and less time than sending them to an 8-week BPST course. You heard a horror story involving one of our inspectors in Coos Bay, a woman who was became an inspector recently. We have talked with Ms. Mattson. She is upset that her name is being used in support of these bills for this reason, because she is very satisfied with the amount of training she's received, the extent and timing of that training, and the limitations that we have placed on her authority to act in view of the amount of training that she has received. And I have a handout that I would like to give to you when I conclude my remarks to indicate the kinds of training that we have provided to Inspector Mattson and some of the restrictions that we have placed on her until she has come up to speed with the other inspectors. Now, one final comment about BPST, and that is that the administrator of BPST informs our director of field services that all OLCC inspectors would have to go through BPST again if House Bill 3032 were enacted, even though they had gone through BPST in the past. Also contrary to, I'm sorry Ms. Botkin has not remained here to hear my remarks, but it is my understanding that our inspectors went through BPST but were not certified, as she indicated. With respect to House Bill 3033, Ms. Botkin indicated that there was a need for clarification of two issues, and that was one of the reasons for the bill. One issue was status. I'd like to point out to you, and I have copies here that I can make available to you. Yes, in 1979 and again in 1984, I indicated to the commission when I was their lawyer that, would you like those?
Mr. Reed, while I'm You're sorting through that. You don't probably need another question on top of this. But I was looking at ORS 471-795, and specifically 471-775, and this is current law, says that inspectors are peace officers. In fact, sub 2 says inspectors and investigators employed by the commission shall have all the authority given by statute to peace officers of this state. That is current law?
Yes, it is, Representative Chairman Burton. The fact of the matter is that I was not the first person from the Attorney General's office to inform the Liquor Commission that their inspectors had limited peace officer authority. And I'd like to present to you at this time a letter from Assistant Attorney General Roland Brown in 1962, which says, Oregon Liquor Control Commission inspectors are not designated as peace officers. They are merely given all the authority of peace officers. And a letter opinion from Attorney General Lee Johnson in 1975, which says the Liquor Control Act does not expressly classify inspectors and investigators as policemen. However, they are given the authority of peace officers. That letter also concludes that outside of their assigned functions, they have no more police responsibility than any other citizen. So it is not entirely accurate to say that for the first time, one Assistant Attorney General in 1979 cast some doubt as to the limitation of their peace officer authority. They've been told this for 25 years. The statute quite clearly gives our inspectors all of the authority of peace officers to deal with violations of the Liquor Control Act. I'm a little bit at a loss to understand what more they need. That authority gives them peace officer authority to do everything that they now do, to give everything that they have indicated that they want to do.
Could they, let me interrupt there, could they arrest someone for, if somebody was visibly intoxicated in a bar and somebody served them a drink, could they arrest the bartender? Or the person who served the alcohol, which is a violation?
Yes, they could. And as a matter of fact, they would not arrest. Normal procedure is not to arrest someone who serves a visibly intoxicated person, because alcohol servers have service permits, and we can deal with them administratively rather than having to force them into the criminal justice system.
The point is not to do the arresting, but to cite the violation.
That is correct.
Thank you.
However, our inspectors do have authority to arrest to arrest or issue citations in lieu of arrest for a variety of misdemeanors in the Liquor Control Act. They have that authority today. They exercise that authority today. Designating them as peace officers would not affect that authority. We believe that we need to continue our practice of working cooperatively with local law enforcement organizations. We recognize that those organizations are strapped, that they have more serious crimes to deal with. However, there are 150 of them for every one of us. We must work together to accomplish the goals that the legislature has set out for all peace officers and for the Liquor Commission in achieving compliance with the Liquor Control Act. Ms. Botkin also indicated that there was some concern and need for clarification of our inspector's job duties. We recognize that there has been a concern along these lines. There have been communication problems. We have tried in the last few months to resolve those difficulties, to make clear what we expect of our inspectors, the authority that they have, and I am not aware of any question whatsoever in the mind of any inspector today as to what the scope of their job duties is, nor am I aware that inspectors are widely dissatisfied with the job duties as laid out for them as they understand them today. Yes, there were some problems during the course of the past 6 months. We believe those problems have been corrected. We do not believe that this legislation, in any event, would resolve those problems if they still existed. Our concerns about the primary responsibility aspect of House Bill 3033 are stated in the handout that I gave to you. Essentially, we're concerned that it would result in a dilution of emphasis on the problem of liquor-related enforcement, both on the part of our inspectors and on the part of local law enforcement. Frankly, we're not aware of anyone, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, who supports these bills except AFSCME on behalf of some and not all of our inspectors. The industry is opposed, as you've already heard. Other segments of the industry are also opposed. The Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association has indicated to me that they are opposed. The OLCC commissioners are opposed. OLCC management is opposed. And we have learned that the following groups are neutral, that they are not opposed. The Statewide MAD Association, the District Attorneys Association, the Sheriff's Association, the Police Chiefs Association have all indicated that they are maintaining a neutral position on these bills. I personally talked with the District Attorney in Klamath County this morning, Mr. Ed Caleb. He indicated that he is pleased with what he understands the direction of the Commission is as he understands it today. He indicated he does not have any concerns with the way we are approaching liquor law enforcement. We are concerned about what these bills would accomplish that may not be apparent on their face. Union representatives have stated that they expect these bills would result in binding arbitration. I disagree with Ms. Botkin. It is very much a legislative determination of whether or not binding arbitration should apply. The Employment Relations Board, when it decides whether or not to accord binding arbitration to a particular segment of a bargaining unit, looks to legislative intent, whether the legislature gave those employees the kinds of responsibilities and duties that are so essential that going on strike should not be permitted. So it is very much a legislative determination. In conclusion, what I think Chairman Hedlund tried to explain to you a few moments ago was the new focus that the Commission has been heading it toward in the past 8 or 9 years, which is to achieve a better balance between service and control. We believe that in the 60s and early to mid 70s, we asked our inspectors to do too much controlling and to provide very little service. We've tried to adjust that balance. We believe in firm but fair enforcement, but we also believe that we are regulating a legitimate industry, an industry which forms an integral part, or our licensees and our permittees form an integral part of an industry which is the third largest industry in the state. We shouldn't treat them as criminals. We shouldn't treat them as the enemy. We should try to work with them because we believe that the majority of the industry are decent, sincere business people who want to comply, and we believe it is our job to help them comply. Those who don't want to comply, then we have to deal with them, and we have to deal with them in whatever manner is necessary to achieve compliance. We leave that up to our inspectors. We give them broad discretion in using a variety of tools of enforcement. The new direction that you've heard about is really nothing more than giving our inspectors more tools for dealing with problems. Rather than simply going out and citing people, they now have education, warnings, and a variety of other tools so that they can decide, based on the facts of each case, what is appropriate and what is necessary in order to achieve compliance. Our program of education was not at all designed to cut back on enforcement of the Liquor Control Act. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Reed. Mr. Hedlund, thank you very much. Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Okay, we'll move to House Bill 3119. I believe Representative Gold wants to be called on this, but Sheriff Pierce, you want to lead off on the testimony on this one?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Officer Julie Salmon, for whom Representative Gold introduced this, is also sitting here if you'd like her to come up. On behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association,
Mr. Ringo?
Yes.
Mr. Ringo?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Robert Ringo. I practice law in Corvallis, Oregon. I welcome my colleague at the bar, Mr. Collins, to come on up and join me and look at my notes so he can respond quickly. He and I have had homicide cases off to each other, and I respect him greatly. It's for you had a work session at 4:30. It looks to me like most of the jury's walked out on the final argument, so I'm not going to make a long one.
Well, this is just a hearing, and the work session, I'm going to have to go out and round up a quorum, but at this point, we're just taking information in, so.
If you could be reincarnated, you'd be better off being a freshman while I'm at you this afternoon out on the grass than here.
It's been tempting. I try not to look out there.
It shows that education doesn't really help a lot. The reason I'm here is this. I think we should be very careful about protecting people who, with no participation of their own, get involved in the justice system, whether it's criminal or civil. You don't have to go back very far to realize that in a civil proceeding, a person's medical records, I always thought there was three things were absolutely confidential: your priest, your doctor, and your spouse. And now we've only got two that are confidential, and that's your priest and your spouse. But in a civil proceeding, just a few years ago, there was no access to a person's medical records until they filed a proceeding, and then only as they relate to that proceeding. Now that's been incorporated into the ORCPs, and all you can really produce, if you read them correctly, Judge Crookham aside, is a medical report, and there's absolutely no access to the doctor's records ad infinitum. My family's and your family's medical records of our children, our spouses, ourselves, contain numerous things which have nothing to do with the proceeding, and they're only interested to somebody that essentially is a window peeper. Now, in a criminal proceeding, I would make the comment, I think, in fairness, where it says that district attorneys should say neither state nor defendant. In a criminal proceeding, many of the district attorneys are sending out criminal subpoenas to treating physicians' offices. The deputy sheriffs are standing there picking up the records and reading the medical records of people that are only a witness. They're absolutely only a witness, and it's no concern of that deputy sheriff or deputy district attorney or a clerk of the district attorney's office, not a party, not a defendant, but only a witness. It's no concern of theirs, whether they come in to there for obesity, whether they come in for a medical problem, they come in for pelvic inflammatory disease, they come in for hypertension. It is absolutely no concern, and they have absolutely no privilege on a witness, because any of us or our spouses or family can be a witness involuntarily in a criminal proceeding, and has nothing to do with relevancy or admissibility. On a witness, all you're concerned about is their competency and nothing more. And I think, in fairness, this subsection should say neither the state or defendant in a criminal proceeding shall be permitted to subpoena the production of a witness or medical records except in the case of a patient who is presently a defendant in a criminal proceeding. That I can go with. Now, as to the subparagraph B, district attorneys, and I have been one, have bragged for many years how you can manipulate and use the grand jury and what a great investigative arm is when your sheriffs are lazy. And we've all seen it and used it. And the grand jury has no more right to the medical records of a witness than anybody else. The medical records are absolutely confidential to the person that unloads to their treating physician. And if those things are going to be placed out in the criminal justice system, I've talked to several of our family physicians in home, and they were aghast that whether it's boy or girl, whether we're all in the sex education era, we're all in those eras, whether it's male or female, that their private medical records of a witness who's not a party to that criminal proceeding can anyway be discovered. And if the prosecution can do it, the defendants can do it. And I know too many defense counsel I wouldn't trust with my wallet, much less my wife's medical records or mine. And the same goes for the district attorneys and deputy sheriffs. And so I think it's very important that we clear up this blank in the rules of civil procedure to make sure that the criminal justice system stays out of our private family history. And I know Mr. Collins wouldn't have any interest in my family's records, and I'm not in his, but we don't all have the character of Mr. Collins.
Collins, you care to comment on that or anything else?
Well, I can't disagree with the last remark, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, I'm John Collins, and I'm testifying in opposition to House Bill 3194 on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I'm not aware of any specific abuses of the subpoena process of private medical records in a criminal case. If there were such abuses, I think there are adequate procedures now to address those without hitting a gnat with a sledgehammer, as would appear to be the nature of this particular bill. If there are abuses, then those can be addressed through motions to quash a subpoena or other procedures if, in fact, they're trying to get a DA or anybody else is trying to get medical records that aren't relevant. I tried to think as I pondered this bill of a couple of instances where this issue might come up, and I thought of two of them. One of them would be in the domestic violence case. It's not uncommon for victims of domestic violence to be unsupportive of the prosecution once the initial arrest is made and a case is filed. If we have a serious assault case, and if this bill would pass, the district attorney would not be able to obtain medical records necessary to the prosecution of the case. In other words, we could not obtain the medical records of the victim, unless, of course, the victim consented to us having those records, and the victim may not do that if, in fact, she's under psychological pressure from the defendant in the case, or there is other reasons why she would not be supportive of the prosecution, and yet the DA, as a public official, feels the public interest is still maintained by prosecution of that case. That's one example, and this bill would prohibit our ability to get needed medical records. The other example I could think of was kind of an unusual example, but involved a rape case that I prosecuted in which the defendant was charged with having sexual intercourse with his 13-year-old daughter. The 13-year-old daughter testified in the case that she also, in addition to becoming pregnant by virtue of the intercourse, contracted a venereal disease. And in the course of the case, it was also learned that the defendant's wife had the same unusual venereal disease. That evidence was produced at trial. The defendant's wife denied having that venereal disease, and so in rebuttal, the wife's medical records were subpoenaed along with the doctor to prove, in fact, she first of all lied to the jury in saying she didn't have it, and second of all, she did have it. And that did have some relevance to proving the fact that the defendant had intercourse with his daughter. So this bill would have made that evidence unavailable, and I think it's relevant, distasteful perhaps, but relevant to that particular case. and would also interfere with our ability to obtain convictions in assault cases of domestic violence. Those are the two instances I can think of. If the records are not relevant, if in fact the DA is abusing discretion by seeking out records to which he has no legitimate interest, then there's other ways to address that problem other than by state statute.
I know of no other way, Mr. Chairman, and the weakness of my fellow's argument is the witnesses very well might not be a wife. They have no notice of it and no opportunity to object to it, and very well could be a long distance away. And if I'm sure Mr. Collins is a skillful enough prosecutor, he could prove that case without humiliating some probably church-going wife that she had a venereal disease, which she might or might not have contacted from her husband. He's a good enough prosecutor to prove his case without stripping away the dignity of some decent woman. Thank you.
Do you have any further questions of me? Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate that. Anyone else wish to be heard on House Bill 3194? House Bill 3083, Ms. Kruger. It's the last bill up for work, for hearing, and then we'll go to work session.
Have a nice dinner. We're going down someplace on the way home, and have a nice dinner. Have a good sandwich, each of you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Carl Kruger, Driver Records Manager, Motor Vehicles Division. House Bill 3083 would have a major impact upon the division. There would be an increased workload for the division and for the most part for the insurance industry, unless some type of automated notification system could be developed. We now receive about 60,000 insurance cancellation notices each year for people who are required to file an SR-22 certificate under our current financial responsibility law. We anticipate that House Bill 3083 would increase the insurance cancellations to about 216,000 for a total of 276,000 notices per year. Based on our experience under the original mandatory auto insurance law in 1978, we believe 85% to 90% of the additional insurance cancellations will represent motorists who either have insurance coverage or are eligible for exemption. The original law required insurance companies to notify the division if a policy was canceled within 120 days. The original mandatory auto insurance law was studied by the House Interim Task Force on Mandatory Insurance. The task force recommended repeal of the 120-day cancellation provision. This requirement was repealed by the 1979 legislature. And I have attached a copy of that task force's report dated November 1978. That concludes my testimony on that bill.
Can you give me an idea of, we have a letter, I'm sorry, just for the record, there was a letter submitted by James Baruch, I guess it is, Branch Vice President of the Safeco, indicating their concern with the problem too, and he makes a statement here. Is that gentleman here, anyone here from that, anyone else here on this bill? Maybe I won't even ask the question. He's talking about the expense of involved would be too great for the benefit received. Any idea what he means by that? That's what he says. He says the expense involved in House Bill 3083 would be too great for the benefit received. Is the expense he's talking about to you? Or the insurance company?
Mr. Chairman, I assume he's referring to his own operation, but also to the division. And the insurance industry's position in the past has been that to require the notification process for all of the drivers in Oregon to get at 10% of those that are uninsured is not cost effective.
Representative Springer?
Carl, you may not be prepared to answer this question today, but I know you folks keep track of the accident records, and is there any way that you folks can give me a ballpark figure on just what the cost is to Oregon drivers and what the total damages are in terms of uninsured accidents?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Springer, again, I'm not prepared to give you that today, okay. but again, we'll make a note of that and provide it to you.
I don't know what Mr. Baruch's costs are. My sense is that in the age of computers, you folks are buying and selling tapes all the time, and I assume they're on computer tapes. I don't think we're necessarily talking about paper transmission. I think we're talking about computer transmission of information. But I appreciate you folks, the information you provided in terms of your earlier study, and I think, of course, we'll review that with interest in terms of how we decide to proceed on this particular legislation. But I can tell you personally, you know, my contact, the public, is very, very, very concerned about uninsured drivers. And until we find some way to enforce the law that we have, my sense is the problem is going to not go away. It's going to get worse. And so we're looking at unacceptable situation, and none of the solutions may be particularly cost-effective from a particular company's point of view or even from DMV's point of view, but in terms of what the public expects, my sense is there's a lot of demand out there that something be done.
One of the examples of that is that people buy cars now with unexpired plates. The question here, confiscation of plates is an issue or a problem in other cases, but they'll buy a tag that's good for 18 months, or they'll go around looking. In fact, in the nickel ads in the newspaper now, you find that as an advertising piece. Instead of saying nice tires, good radio, it'll say good tags. My understanding is that uninsured motorists will buy that, or drug dealers will buy those cars with the intent of getting a tag that's good. They don't have to go back through the registration process. Or they'll buy insurance and cancel it as soon as possible after. So it is a problem. And if you have some ideas, I'm sure you do. You know who sponsored this bill? It comes out of the Committee on Business and Consumer Affairs, but I assume it was at somebody's, I don't know.
No, Mr. Chairman, we don't.
Seek out the sponsor.
I will add, though, that, you know, the motor vehicles is sympathetic and aware, mm-hmm. and as I placed in my testimony, any of these programs I think would be great, and we would really favor if we could head maybe in a direction of an automated system where those cancellations would be done electronically. It's the paper that you know, we want to bring to your attention of the cost.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, that ends the hearings. We're going to go to work session. We need to take a 2-minute recess, hopefully, to go. I think I want to do that just for a minute. I know I'm ready to move, however, particularly on the committee. You can move out there, but I'm going to be on the committee to leave the room, or you need to go make a phone call. We'll come right back. Just take a break and come back to work session.
Would you take it terribly personal if I step down the hall?
That's now on 2333. And for members of the subcommittee, Representative Phillips, we're on, we just gaveled down on House Bill 2333. Okay. And I should explain that, I don't know what everybody has, but it's the big one, but it's been amended. And the amendments are the ones that we want to work off of, because you may have several sets floating about. The ones that are the state-of-art amendments are, it's wishy-washy, it's 2333-2, which is LC 1742. And I think Corey is coming back up from the governor's office, but I don't know if, there you are.
Hey.
Would you like to join us, Ms. Toombs? You want to join us on, this is House Bill 2333, and I was just trying to explain to the committee here that the amendments, which are, did Keith want to come up too? Keith Stubblefield, did you want to have anybody else you want to have come up? Okay. House Bill 2333-2 is actually the amendments that we're working on. So do you want to explain what we've done to the bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually don't have a copy of the, of 2333-2, but I assume that it is the set that I have in front of me with the changes that I'm familiar with. There are three sets of amendments to the bill, actually.
But we don't care about two of them. That's what I want to, make sure we've got all the amendments that we're going to pertain to.
My understanding is that 2333-2 contains three sets of amendments that we do want in and does not contain the additional set that we don't want in.
Okay, just to...
What do we
it's
want?
Not, it's not
want.
Sets of amendments. 2333-2 is would amend the bill. Anything else we don't want to bother about? Because there's another set of amendments which are titled 2333-1, and those are not presented as amendments. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
I know that you do it red, blue, green, and coded colors, but we have to be a little bit different here. So
right.
We're working off of 2333-2. Everybody clear on that? Am I clear on that? Yes. Proceed. I've been here too long today. Go ahead.
The amendments that are contained in 2333-2, I believe, are as follows. First, the amendments remove the Commission on Corrections from the bill and restore the Community Corrections Act Advisory Board. Initially, a change was contemplated, and those amendments return the legislation to its present shape and don't, in fact, make that change. Second, the amendments include a direction to the Department of Human Resources to ensure that even though corrections will be removed from Human Resources, the Department of Human Resources will still maintain responsibility for providing social services and rehabilitative services to inmates. So the Department of Human Resources is affirmatively directed to coordinate with the Department of Corrections on those issues. Third, there are some technical amendments which were missed in the bill the first time around, conforming amendments, substituting department for division, and so on. Now, at one time it was contemplated, and I know a number of people have heard that it was contemplated, to add additional provisions to this bill, to change the community corrections system in some respects, to require uniform judgment orders and some other items like that. Those are not included in these amendments. They will, I understand, be moved to HB 2428. They are not in HB 2333.
Okay, it's my understanding then that those amendments which were in here relating to community correction, all that have been drafted into 2428 so that if this group decides it wants to hear those, we can do that through that vehicle. But essentially, what we have then is a bill that creates a Department of Corrections, leaves a Community Corrections Advisory place in board, and requires coordination of certain functions and activities relating to human resource functions to remain in place.
That's correct.
And then that's the effect of all of this, which is a major move, but it takes that department out and makes it report directly to the governor.
That's right.
Are there's questions? Representative Phillips.
Just so I'm absolutely clear, your synopsis, Mr. Chair, you can tell me that this absolutely changes the effective way community corrections are operated in the state in no way whatsoever, other than the fact that they'll be reporting or working with a Department of Corrections rather than a Division of Corrections.
That's right. Mr. Toombs?
That's absolutely correct.
Okay.
Representative Springer?
Well, I would move the amendments to as proposed 2333-2.
Representative Springer moves the amendments, which are LC 1742, House Bill 2333-2.
Mr. Chair, just to that motion, because we just did receive these this morning, I think it would be prudent, and I'm sure our council will, before the bill hits full committee, want to take some opportunity just to review them once again, perhaps. I don't know if we want to ask our council to hand engross this, because it's going to be quite a project, but we will review them, I suspect, within our own staff, just to make sure that it's never hurts to double check on this process, particularly when you're dealing with an issue that as important as this, and we will, as a matter of course, do that prior to full committee action on the bill, assuming favorable consideration today.
Yeah. To that point, this might be nitpicking, Tom, but if you look at the last part of the bill, it talks about men or male persons committed. should that, I mean, is there a way to clean this up so we're talking about men and women when we talk about Department of Corrections, Section 208A? And I don't mean to be picky about it, but going along with Representative Springer.
I don't have a copy before me. Perhaps I can.
Yeah, they're a little bit here.
They released OSP, so I think that gender reference may be appropriate in that context.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
We don't confine women at OSP.
Let's make sure we get that on the record to the question. You want to
The reference, Mr. Chairman, Representative Phillips, is to the penitentiary, which is exclusively established for the purpose of incarcerating male felons. So in that context, I believe it's correct.
Okay.
To the motion, the comment that Representative Springer made, you have that. You have this. You don't have it, but there is the reference here. Section 20A is amended to. I'm sorry. I got it. Never mind. I'm suddenly understanding where we're at. Okay. The motion.
What happens on the first reading of amendments sometimes?
The thing is that this is the bill is a rather hefty one. Things that are in here are changes. The reason it's so large is because it changes from division to department. You have to do that all the way through it. That's a reference to it. The amendments really, in a sense, are not that significant either because it adds this article, agreement of attainers. The rest of those are fairly technical in nature, so it's really sort of whole, if you would, in any case. So the motion is made. Is there any... to adopt the amendments. Is there any discussion on that? Any objections? If not, we'll adopt the amendments. And I'd appreciate a chair to move move this to the committee with a do pass recommendation. Care to make that motion?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Springer moves to take House Bill 2333 as amended to the full committee with a do pass recommendation. The clerk will call. Discussion?
Tom or Corey, I got to admit, this is the first day we've seen these. Have others in the corrections field had an opportunity to review these amendments, such as community corrections workers or directors around the state, people like that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Phillips, not the particular amendments that are before you, given the fact that it doesn't have any real impact on them. Those have not been, they've not, to my knowledge, had access to them. The other ones that pertain to the Community Corrections Act and would have some measure of controversy associated with them will be taken up at a later date, subject to your discretion. And, of course, then they should have a window of opportunity to comment on those.
Okay. Fine.
I might mention that... in that light, that I think we had a number of, I received information from some community corrections people and others in the area on the proposals that were made to change the community corrections aspect of this at one time, and I think it was given that we wanted to get the department created and that those should be dealt with in a separate arena, and that was what we're doing. So we probably will still hear more yet on the community corrections aspect.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add a word, Representative Phillips, it is our intention, And this is responsive to your earlier question as well, is our intention not to make any substantive changes whatsoever to community corrections. If council discovers that accidentally something was left out or included that shouldn't have been, it is not our intention to have that happen, and we assume that can be taken care of.
Yeah, Corey, I know that, but I guess I get concerned so that we don't have people coming off the wall saying they snuck these things in and we didn't get a chance to review them. And whether it affects them or not, it is their field of expertise. And I'm not just talking about the community people. There's the sheriffs and all those other people that would be affected by corrections. So there's more self-defense than anything else.
Okay. Clerk, call the roll.
Bauman?
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Burton?
Aye. Okay. Well, I got you here. Let's go to House Bill 2437. And that is the so-called ABC felon bill, which I have somewhere in my file. There is amendments there.
Okay.
which are and I'm a little confused on this one, I guess, as far as the numbering on this. LC draft 1641, which is titled Legislative Council HB 2437-2 amendments. And let me question I've got is what was 2437-1? But these amendments were drafted at my request. Basically what the amendment says, it replaces essentially the bill. So we're getting the bill. And you can read in section one of the proposed amendments that it's declared to be the policy of the state of Oregon that to the extent practicable, the state shall be responsible for incarceration of persons convicted of crimes defined as felonies, except the court. If the court imposes a punishment that makes a crime a misdemeanor, then the county and not the state shall be responsible for the incarceration resulting from the conviction. That's a policy statement, which is what we're trying to at least achieve at this point. The original bill simply directed that would occur, and I think that it was in politic to understand that the funding to achieve this really isn't there. The cost of doing that immediately is one of resources. But we did want to get the policy determination there for this session, hopefully, as a means of achieving that goal. And then section two requires the governor to study the policy and to report to the next legislative assembly a proposal for implementation of the policy, including an estimated cost, and allows him to delegate that to a task force or state agency. And it would be my assumption that that would be given to the Corrections Strategic Planning Task Force. So that's what the proposed amendments do. And I'd be glad to entertain a motion or discussion of that.
Perhaps a question first, Mr. Chair. I think it might be good for the record to hear from the governor's office as to who they plan to delegate to be the appropriate task force or state agency responsible.
Mr. Chair, Representative Phillips, that task will most likely be delegated to the governor's task force on corrections planning.
Most likely. 90% most likely or 55% most likely?
90% most likely.
Do you have, Mr. Chair, you drafted these. Do you have a fiscal impact on this?
As far as the amendment itself goes, I have not. My assumption would be that there would, since if in fact this was assigned, this task was assigned to the Corrections Task Force, there's already funds provided for them to proceed. Obviously, and one of the questions there to come back with is what the cost of implementation of this would be and how we'd implement it. I have